Ring the bell, sucker, if you dare. This is Movie Fighters, the show where Chris Sims and I, Matt Wilson, we watch movies and we beat them up. And Chris, I'm just going to go ahead and tell them. I'm going to reveal our situation here.
Pull back the curtain, Matt.
We had originally planned on this episode of Movie Fighters, number 99, to watch 2019's Hellboy.
I had bits planned?
Yes.
Because this has been the plan for like 2 months.
Yes. We had read in articles on the internet, which you must believe. Obviously, they're true.
Look, the ones that we write, we got to do research on. We have to cite sources.
Some kind of confusion occurred where there were many reports that Hellboy was going to be going to, many of them said, dumped on Amazon Prime in July. That did not happen. It is instead available for rent for $5.99.
That is not the Movie Fighters way.
I mean, we have done it before. We have paid to watch a movie for Movie Fighters before, but surely Hellboy will be available on a streaming service in the near future. So we are going to hold off for a moment on watching Hellboy 2019. Instead, we had to pivot to something else that's kind of spooky.
Because it's fall now, everybody, and fall is spooky times.
Fall is spooky times, and what better name for this season than Season of the Witch, the 2011 American historical fantasy adventure film starring Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman.
The historical is doing a lot. is at, in that sentence wondering, how did I get here? It is historical in the way that my D&D game that we play is historical, Matt.
Well, there is a hint of real history in the plot to this movie, as I understand it. Because, essentially, Nicolas Cage is playing a knight, a Teutonic knight, who is tasked with removing a witch from the city, who is being blamed for the Black Plague. So the Black Plague is something that really happened in history.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I suppose, the historical part of this film.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
All right.
I suspect. I mean, who knows? Maybe we'll get some... Maybe this will be like Assassin's Creed, and every character in this movie is someone who really existed.
And it turns out they're really part of a secret cabal trying to run the world.
Yeah, I don't know anything about this movie.
For a relatively high-profile movie that did reasonably well, it made $91.6 million at the box office on a budget of $40 million. So, successful.
Because it's got that star power, baby.
And with a considerable amount of star power, boy, is it completely forgotten. Who talks about Season of the Witch anymore?
Lana Del Rey.
She did make a song about it in 2019. It is for the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark soundtrack.
That's what we should have. Okay, we almost watched The Vampire's Assistant, but The Vampire's Assistant is 110 minutes long. So,
yeah,
definitely not.
Also, absolutely worth noting, this movie shares a title with the subtitle of Halloween 3.
The one that no one likes.
The one that is the sleeper best Halloween movie.
Yeah, Silver Shamrock, baby. That's the one. I did a panel on horror movies last weekend at a convention. Or I did a panel on horror stories.
How did you end up on fucking a horror movie panel?
It was a horror story panel, and it's because I've done Army of Darkness comics, and I've done comics with Dracula.
I see, okay.
And so I had to be the guy who's like, I do not like horror movies. I do not enjoy being scared.
Right, because, look, I was pushing hard for us to watch Happy Death Day.
I don't want to put the burden on the listeners, Matt, but if Happy Death Day is not going to scare me. We can watch it. Because it is a movie written by professional comic book writer Scott Lobdell.
Yes.
Currently working on that comic about Wally West that talks about how great he did at tracking down those bits.
Yes, correct. And has the magical premise of horror Groundhog Day.
Which is brilliant.
Yes.
I wish I could say that that was not like the best premise in the world.
And so I was like kind of pushing for it, but Chris, you were worried about it being too scary. So instead, we kind of opted for the sort of like PG-13 supernatural adventure genre, which would include Season of the Witch. Mm-hmm. We talked about doing that Solomon Kane movie from 2009.
In celebration of Marvel getting the rights to Solomon Kane, apparently.
And we also discussed Cirque du Freak, The Vampire's Assistant, another widely forgotten film.
Yes, that I believe is based on a book.
Here's something that's not particularly encouraging about 2011 Season of the Witch. It is the director's last film.
Oof. Yikes.
Dominic Sena has mainly been known as a music video director. He directed a lot of like big music videos in the mid-80s to mid-90s. And he started directing films in 1993 with California, spelled with a K. Mm-hmm. Then he directed Gone in 60 Seconds in 2000, which explains his connection to Nicolas Cage. In 2001, he directed Swordfish. You know, that movie where Hugh Jackman is a hacker?
Yeah. He's Hugh Hackman.
That's right. Yeah. In 2009, he directed the film Whiteout, which is the adaptation of the Greg Rucka comic.
Right.
And 2011 Season of the Witch.
Greg Rucka, Steve Lieber.
That's right. Greg, sorry, did not intend to leave out Steve Lieber. And then 2011 Season of the Witch. Nothing else on the filmography. Five movies. Hasn't been one in 8 years.
Yeah, Season of the Witch. When you've done it all, Matt, you don't need to do anymore.
I mean, that's a fair assessment. We will see if Season of the Witch was – if once you made it, you're like, done. What else do I need to do? I've done it all. My number one worry about Season of the Witch, and Chris, I know you share this, is that it will be boring.
It'll be too scary?
Absolutely not. It will be boring.
Yes.
It does have a score of 10% on Rotten Tomatoes. Okay, here's one reason why it might not be boring.
Okay.
Nicolas Cage did earn a Razzie Award for Worst Actor.
Yeah, they always like to give it to him, though, no matter what he's doing. Which is...
I mean, Nicolas Cage is at least going to make some interesting choices.
Yes. I think we have never watched Con Air for this show, but, like, Con Air's really good.
Yeah, that's the thing. Nicolas Cage does not change. His performances are always Nicolas Cage performances. Yet, they can be the absolute dirt worst, or they can be transcendent and wonderful.
Yeah.
Like the Nicolas Cage of The Wicker Man, which has become a universal joke, is the same Nicolas Cage who's in Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans.
Yeah.
The same Nicholas.
Same guy who's in Adaptation.
Same guy who's in National Treasure.
Absolutely the same guy who's in Moonstruck.
Yes.
don't even front. Like,
the same guy who's in Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
That's all the same guy.
It's all the same guy.
There are not two Nicolas Cages.
There's only one.
There's only one. And... like, Face Off Nicolas Cage is absolutely the same Nicolas Cage who's in, like, prestige films.
Yeah, Face Off rules.
Face Off does rule. They're remaking it. So
who are they remaking it with?
I don't think that's been announced yet.
Every time anybody says they're remaking something and I don't know who they're remaking it with, I like to think of it like it's the new Space Jam movie and it's LeBron James.
You know, not a bad idea.
Matt, please leave that long pause as you tried to come to grips with a world where LeBron James was in Face Off.
What if it was LeBron James and Kyrie Irving?
Oh, yes. Yes. Hell yes.
So, okay, I'm looking at the critical reception section of the Wikipedia page for this movie. And Chris, I don't know what to believe here.
Okay.
Because the Los Angeles Times called this swords and sorcery romp a colossal waste of time.
Yikes.
Variety said it was both overblown and undercooked. Yet, Tom Huddleston of Time Out London, not Hiddleston, Huddleston, said, despite its admirably straight face, Season of the Witch is a silly romp through Python-esque medieval cliche, a knockabout hammer horror with a dash of cut price Tolkien chucked in to keep things moving.
Mm? You have my interest.
He said, Season of the Witch is not for everyone. It's creaky, predictable, and frequently idiotic. But for a tipsy Saturday night, it should tick all the right boxes.
Ooh, Matt, now I'm not drinking. It's 1:32 p.m. on our Saturday.
That's true.
But I could drink. I could start.
I mean, we'll see how it goes when we start. But like, so it's either deeply boring, a colossal waste of time, mm-hmm. or an absolute goofy B-movie schlock fest.
Here is the
one
problem.
Of those I want.
Yes. I mean, two of those I want, because like, it's going to be a waste of time, Matt. We're spending the next 90 precious minutes that we have a finite number of on this planet to watch this film. I don't want to get depressing, but I mean, that's what's up, if you want to get down to it. Here's my problem, Matt. On my desk in front of me, I have my snack.
Yeah.
And I have a Nintendo Switch.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's in my office. That Nintendo Switch has Super Metroid in it.
Sure.
And it also has a new Zelda game in it, which is completely new to me because I never played Link's Awakening the first time around. So this movie is competing with Super Metroid, because if I get bored, Matt, I'm playing Super Metroid.
Well, that can be one measure of how we rate this movie after we watch it.
Yeah, I think we need to do everything on the like Super Metroid scale. Obviously, no movie that we watch, like Uncle Drew, is maybe like a 1.2 Super Metroids.
It may be the only movie we have watched for Movie Fighters that surpasses Super Metroid, if I'm being 100.
If you're keeping it 100.
That's right.
Like Uncle Drew would want you to.
Uncle Drew would tell me straight up to keep it 100.
He would.
All right. We're going to watch Season of the Witch.
We're going to stop having this bizarre conversation.
Yeah. It's on Netflix if you want to watch along with us. It is mercifully short, at the very least, at 1 hour and 34 minutes. So that's part of the reason we chose not to watch The Vampire's Assistant, because it is almost 2 full hours.
I wish we had that movie where Jack Black has a house with a clock in its walls. I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah, it has like a really esoteric title.
Yeah.
Before we watch the movie, though, Chris, it's time for the hottest segment in all of podcasting. It's time for Snack Situation. Chris, what are you snacking on for Season of the Witch?
Matt, it's fall. That's why we're watching this.
That's right.
And as faithful Snack Situation listeners know, fall means one thing for me. It's motherfucking apple season.
Yeah,
so I'm going old school, Matt. I got an apple out of the fridge. I put it through my little crank machine that peels and cores it and slices it up. I love that thing. If you don't have one, you should get it. It's worth it. It looks like it's from a farm. I love it. And I also got a little big old spoonful of peanut butter on the plate. I'm having some apples and peanut butter, Matt.
Very classic. Is this... I would suspect that you have already eaten through the NC Apple Festival apples.
No, this is from the NC Apple Festival. You would be surprised to learn that I have not jammed on them yet.
Okay. Well, continuing from our snack situation then, our snack situation for September episode.
Matt, what are you snacking on? Do you have anything seasonally appropriate?
I'm also continuing from our an episode of something we've recorded, but it's War Rocket Ajax when I talked about being really into almonds now. Snacking on almonds a lot.
Matt's into almonds now, everybody. If you don't listen to Ajax, Matt's into almonds.
Yeah. And I have in front of me opened the Bold Habanero Barbecue Blue Diamond Almonds. I wanted to like make it hot for Hellboy.
Uh-huh.
You know, I wanted it to be a little warm.
Right.
But
sadly, that ceased to be a concern.
That ceased to be a concern. So instead, it's going to be like, I don't know, warm for the fires in plague-ridden Europe.
It's keeping you warm as we get into fall.
As we get into the season of the witch. That's right.
This chilly season here in North Carolina, where around about 10 a.m. it is back up to 80 degrees.
Where you live. I'm up in these high elevations.
That's right. Are you getting some chills? Some chills and thrills up there in Asheville?
It's a little cool. It's a little cool.
It's a little cool.
That's right. So those are our snacks. As I mentioned, you can watch Season of the Witch along with us on Netflix. We will be back after an ad and a musical interlude, and we will talk about this movie. And we are back from watching Season of the Witch, a 2011 film starring Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman. I'm afraid that I kind of ruined it right at the start.
I'm afraid we've got some bad news about Season of the Witch starring Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman.
Because there's a scene that opens this film where some priests, some holy men, are putting three women on trial for witchcraft. And then those women are hanged and dunked in the river for some reason.
They hang them off the side of a bridge, and then they like dip them in the river. Like a tea bag.
Exactly like a tea bag.
Like you would steep your tea. They're steeping some witches in the river, which seems not the best idea.
I mean, maybe that's based on something. I don't know. I mean, it's pretty markedly different from the traditional burning witches thing to begin with. So there's a whole thing with Rory McCann, who you may know as the Hound from Game of Thrones.
Who's only in the movie for like 2 minutes. I was really expecting him to be more in it.
He's only in it kind of like right at the beginning.
Yeah.
But he's like pulling their bodies out of the water, and the head priest guy is getting mad at him for that.
No. He doesn't pull them out of the water.
Oh, that's right.
The priest is like, hey, now that we've steeped our witch tea in this river, now we got to get them out. And he's like, it's good enough for me. Because he's the Hound.
Perfect Hound impression.
Thank you.
And
we were both doing a lot of impressions over the course of watching this movie.
We were. But because the way people talk in this movie is bananas, and we'll get to it.
It's wild.
But he goes walking off for reasons that I don't really understand. He might be under some demonic influence or something.
No, I think he just sucks.
Maybe he just sucks. But
because the priest is like, hey, now we got to get him out so that we can do some rites from the Lesser Key of Solomon.
Oh, and he's like, who cares about the rites?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm going to go get a drink.
I've got to go fight my brother.
Me brother.
The mountain.
These are terrible impressions of Gordon McCann, who I quite like.
Yeah, they're pretty awful. Because he's got kind of like an almost Irish accent. Anyway, so...
I don't want to do the rites.
He goes walking off, and one of the witches, who's still dunked in the river tea, comes flying out and attacks the priest. And she's got kind of like sharp teeth and a demon face.
Yeah, it does seem, Matt, you described this movie as like it's threatening to turn into Army of Darkness at all times, but that's, never actually does.
That's how I ruined this movie.
Yeah.
Because throughout the entire thing from that point on, it was just like, this isn't Army of Darkness.
Yeah.
And
which is a real shame, because that movie rules.
Yeah, even in the moments where it kind of, like, edges somewhat close to Army of Darkness. And at the end, it kind of does. There are some
Adam Copeland's right up to being Army of Darkness.
It very nearly has some Deadites in it at the end. But it does not have the tone of Army of Darkness. It has a lot of the same kind of, like, look of Army of Darkness, with mm-hmm. particularly the lighting.
They definitely do the we are shooting everything in daytime so that people can actually see it, but we are going to put that big blue nighttime filter on it.
Uh-huh.
I watched a movie last night, Aiden and I watched Falling in Love about okay. the Matt, she's got like a fast paced New York City lifestyle.
Sure.
But then she wins an inn in New Zealand, and, you know, she kind of learns to slow down a little bit.
Is it a Hallmark film?
No, it is a Netflix original, my man.
Okay. It's a Netflix original version of a Hallmark film.
Yes. Matt, you know I love a Netflix original rom-com. You know I love The Christmas Prince.
Sure.
But the thing with this one is there's a scene where it's nighttime. And, like, it's, like, an exterior shot of her inn that she's working on. And they very clearly CGI the moon in. And I don't know why. Like, because it's already dark.
It's like, it's you didn't nighttime. Need
to convince me it was nighttime.
You have to make it very clear that it's nighttime. But, yeah, it's got, like, that kind of Army of Darkness look at times. Some of the monsters have an Army of Darkness thing. But never does it get to that type of tone. Never is it fun. Like Army of Darkness is fun.
That's the thing. It's never fun. The movie's never fun.
Yeah.
Which sucks.
It sucks. It gets schlocky and goofy, and Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman are obviously just like, I don't know, they're kind of just cashing a check here.
Yeah. They're very much just cashing a check.
But like, not that they're out and out bad. Like, they do fine. But they're not really, like, putting on... They certainly don't put on accents.
Okay, we'll get to that in a second, but yes.
They don't really... They're not really anything but themselves. Which
makes... There's exactly one accent in this movie, and it's fucking hilarious.
Yeah. There's also, like, Nicolas Cage's character has this arc that makes no sense because he kind of doesn't change throughout the movie.
No, he doesn't change at all.
Yeah. But so his biggest change comes right at the beginning, because after that opening scene, we cut to these two soldiers, Sir Baiman von Bilbrook, who is Nicolas Cage, and Sir Felson, who never gets a first name.
Baymax and Felson.
Yeah. And we had a bit of difference because I wanted to know how these two guys know each other. And you were fine with the idea of them just being war buddies.
I could not believe that you wanted to know more about these two characters. That,
like, it seemed like they had some connection just beyond being in the Crusades together. Like, it seemed like they had a backstory. Like, they were related somehow, or they grew up together, or something. But it is never even hinted at.
Yeah, and I see no reason why it should be. Like, we see them fighting in the Crusades together. They're talking. Like, like that's their background. Like, Matt, they were in the Crusades together.
So we see them fighting first in a battle in 1332, where Nicolas Cage has the funniest wig on ever.
It's extremely good, because we need to see it grow out into the wig that he is wearing eventually in the film.
It's like a little Lord Fauntleroy cut. It's kind of blonde, even though it gets dark later. It's so hilarious. It's very good. Kind of could not focus on anything but his hair in this whole scene, even though there's a discussion happening throughout this whole thing where Ron Perlman and Nicolas Cage are kind of bantering with each other throughout the battle about who was going to buy drinks that night.
Yeah. Whoever kills the most Muslims, I guess, is the,
pretty much.
Here's the thing. They do eventually realize the Crusades are bad, which is nice.
7 years.
It does take 7 years.
Because the first battle we see them in is in 1332. The last battle we see them in is in 1339. And in between, they're like fighting in the snow, and they grew beards, and they're fighting in the desert. And, you know, we see a lot of their like travels fighting throughout the Crusades.
Yeah. And then, like, what sets off poor Nicolas Cage, Baymax, is that they're sieging a city. And
yeah, it is Arta.
Yeah, they're sieging Arta. Nicolas Cage accidentally kills a lady, and it's this innocent person who has died,
who also looks very white.
Yeah, there is also that.
Yeah,
I mean, like they definitely cover up a lot of these people they're fighting in the Crusades. There's a lot of those intense scarves around their heads.
But the implication is that Nicolas Cage, like, they're fine with killing as many brown people as they need to.
Yeah.
But as soon as he harms a white lady, it's like, oh no, I'm doing a bad thing.
Yeah, that is an uncomfortable subtext to this. The actual text is that he has been in the Crusades for 7 years, and this is the first time he has killed someone he doesn't think deserves it, which is a little upsetting.
Yeah, he runs off to the sort of like lead. I guess he's like the master of the Teutonic Knights. And he tells the guy, like, hey, what we're doing is actually wrong, and we shouldn't be doing it. And the master of the knights is like, I speak for God, and we're doing what God says to do. And Nicolas Cage is like, well, God doesn't want this, as if what they're doing is now vastly changed.
7 years.
It's pretty much exactly what we saw them doing in the first battle scene. He just happened to kill a white lady.
Think about where you were at in your life 7 years ago.
Uh-huh.
In 2012.
What a time.
Yeah. Now imagine spending all of that time just straight up doing murders in hilarious armor.
Every day.
Which I think is where the Monty Python, the Python-esque line comes from.
Absolutely.
It is like, I mean, here's the thing, is that like Monty Python is basically wearing like SCA gear, right? So looks like Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman are like LARPing. Which is very funny.
Yeah. I mean, it is essentially, you know, the sort of semi-historical Crusades armor of the period.
Yeah.
But it does look like they're just going to a con and trying to look like, you know, Sir Bedivere.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
If only it was, like, funny. But, like, I feel like a lot of the comparisons that you read out in the beginning are very accurate. Like, they are very clearly trying to do a Hammer riff, which we know because fucking Christopher Lee shows up.
Christopher Lee has one scene and then a quick later appearance where his character has died because he has the plague. He shows up as Cardinal D'Ambrose, because to go through the plot a little bit more, after Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman say this is wrong, they desert. They go walking off, and they head back home to Germany?
Yeah, I guess. I guess Germany?
They get discovered because somebody sees the crest on Nicolas Cage's sword. So they're discovered as deserters, and they're arrested. Then, as they're about to be taken to a dungeon and hanged or burned or whatever it is that they do to deserters, which is a conversation that is had later, they're instead stopped because Nicolas Cage gets recognized as the famous Baymon von Bilbrook.
I'm alarmed that you can remember his name.
I'm looking at it on Wikipedia. But he's recognized as this like great soldier from the Crusades. And so then he is taken, he and Ron Perlman are taken to Cardinal D'Ambrose. Cardinal Dean Ambrose, who's played by Christopher Lee. Christopher Lee is buried under a ton of makeup because he has the plague. And you can't really tell he's Christopher Lee until he starts talking.
Yes.
But he's 100% Christopher Lee. And he says, look, we got this real bad plague. You didn't hear about it because you were out in the Crusades.
Yeah, you were out in the Crusades. You probably didn't hear about the plague, which definitely didn't spread to anywhere else.
Yeah.
But
we've had the plague for 3 years out here, and people are dying. People are just...
Maybe if you guys had gotten tired of murdering people after, like, 3 years? 3 or 4 years? Maybe you could have done something about it, but...
And we need somebody to take the cause of this plague, who is a witch, who we've got down in the dungeon. We need her to be taken to Sevarak, which is, I guess, a holy city. And
it's something.
It's something. It's a place where a bunch of monks are going to perform a ritual.
It's a monastery where they have the Lesser Key of Solomon, which That's is right. a... If you listen to other podcasts that may feature Chrisms and or Matt Wilson, you may know the Lesser Key of Solomon as being Solomon's book of demon stuff that he does.
Yeah, so apparently this place, this monastery, is the only place that has that book, and the monks there can perform a ritual to determine for sure if this young woman is a witch. Well, they can give her a fair trial. And then sort of purge her, thereby eliminating the plague.
Yeah, they can unwitch her. They can do the rites that were supposed to be done at the beginning. And so she will – her witch powers will go away. And then the plague will stop, I guess, because they will have killed her and also like sanctified the body.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're getting at.
But because he hates the church now, Nicolas Cage demands that the witch be given a fair trial. That's his one condition, is that she has to be given an absolutely fair trial. They are sent to the dungeon to stay until they set off on their quest. And while in the dungeon, they meet the witch, who's played by Claire Foy, who never gets a name. I don't think her name is ever said.
Until
the very end of the movie.
That was Claire Foy?
That was Claire Foy.
Like from The Crown?
Yeah.
No.
That was her.
No way. Like, no.
It was her.
Okay, because here's the thing is she was not good in this film. Oh, this was her first movie.
Yeah.
Like she had done like TV stuff before that, but and I do not blame her for not being good as Anna, because she's like the script is bad is the problem. We're gonna get to it, but the script is bad.
I said she didn't get a name, and then I remembered that like they do that thing at the end of the movie where now that she's like spoiler alert, undemoned, where she's like, oh, my name is Anna.
My name is Anna.
It's like
I can tell you all about what it was like.
Yeah, it's like at the end of Metal Gear Solid, where Solid Snake's like, David, my name is David.
Is Solid Snake's name David?
According to the end of Metal Gear Solid 1, his name's David. So.
Solid Snake is a cooler name than David.
What about Iroquois Plissken, though? That is his assumed name in Metal Gear Solid 2. Anyway.
I gotta get into Metal Gear, but do go on. I can't believe this is Claire Foy, I guess is what I'm getting at. It's shocking.
Claire Foy and Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman start to feel bad for her because she's clearly been beaten. She's been tortured by this sort of lead priest from the town that they're in, De Belzac, who has the goofiest name in the world.
Yeah, that's the thing. All the names in this movie are exceptionally goofy.
Yeah.
There's Baiman von Bilderberg.
Yeah.
There's De Belzac. There's Hagarth is Alphonse's character.
Hagamar. Yeah.
There's Hagamar. And there's I feel like there's Kai.
Kai.
Spelled K-A-Y.
Yeah. There's a character
they're
named
very bad.
Eckhart, which I couldn't think about anything but think about the future.
Think about the future, yep.
So those are all the named characters pretty much. Speaking of Hagamar, before the party sets off, which the party consists of Baiman Felsen, De Belzac, and this guy Hagamar.
There's another guy.
Well, Kai shows up later. Oh, no,
there's the nice knight.
There's Eckhart. That's Eckhart.
Oh, that's Eckhart? Okay.
Yeah. That's right. Eckhart's in the party too. But they go find Hagamar. He's in the stocks, locked up.
Okay. Can I do the intro to Hagamar?
Please do.
Okay. Nicolas Cage walks up and goes, "Are you Hagamar the Swindler?" And the guy in the stocks goes, "Yeah. I mean, no, I ain't a swindler, but I am Hagamar." And it's wild.
They need Hagamar because they need a guide. And Hagamar is one of the only people who has drawn maps and stuff.
He's been to Sazerac. He's been to where they're going, and Nicolas Cage doesn't trust the maps.
Yeah. Now, Hagamar is played by an actor named Stephen Graham, who, despite often playing characters with New York accents, for example, he played Al Capone in Boardwalk Empire.
Uh-huh.
He's English. He's from Merseyside. He is as English as you could possibly imagine. And in this movie, set in medieval times during the plague, he's like, "We gotta go up there on over, and we're in the cursed forest.
I say we kill her right now."
What was the name of the forest that they went through?
It was the Wormwood Forest.
Yeah. Hey, we're in the Wormwood Forest. It's
where are we, Hagamar?
It's like being out in the Pine Barrens. It's so bad, the way he talks.
The thing that we couldn't figure out was why, because we mentioned it before, but the accents in this movie are all over the fucking map. Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman do not do accents, and I wasn't sure at the beginning if I was glad or really bummed out that they're not doing accents.
There is one moment where Nicolas Cage kinda does an accent.
He it's like he's trying it on in a couple scenes, but he ultimately, "Oh no, I think I'm gonna stick with this."
Yeah.
The Al Capone is doing that voice.
Yeah.
Which I assume is the voice he used on Boardwalk Empire. I've only seen a little bit of that show.
Very similar, yeah.
And then Claire Foy is speaking with an accent.
She's speaking in her natural speaking voice, I believe. Yeah.
The other Eckhart has an accent.
And the actor who plays Eckhart, he might be the only character kind of not doing his natural accent because he's from Denmark.
Okay.
So he's kind of doing an English accent. Christopher Lee just speaks as Christopher Lee,
yeah,
essentially. And then De Belzac also speaks with his natural English accent. Stephen Campbell Moore is from England.
Yeah. Which is, like, look, it's fine. It's absolutely fine. Like, this is, like I said, the word history is really out of place. But it's not like I am expecting accent accuracy. It's not like in... I saw the movie Troy, the Trojan War movie that has no gods in it, because who the fuck wants to see the gods in the Trojan War? That's
the one with Brad Pitt?
The one with Brad Pitt, yeah, as Achilles! And Brian Cox is in that movie, speaking with his regular accent, and the guy playing his brother has a completely different accent. And a friend of mine was like, took me right out of the movie.
Yeah, understandable.
So yeah, I'm willing to let people have just not do accents in this movie. When the demon shows up and starts talking, however, yeah,
we'll get to it. We'll get to it. We definitely need to talk about how the demon speaks when we get to that. But they set off on their journey, and immediately once they set off on their journey, they notice that they're being followed, and the person following them is Kai von Wallenbarth. Another wonderful name, who has been sent by the Cardinal to keep an eye on them, because they still don't trust Baemin and Felsen, basically. So he joins the party very quickly when he is very easily noticed following them.
Yeah.
Then
because he is pretty good at fighting.
Yeah, he's okay. Then begins what I would call the doughy middle of the film.
Ooh, that is when things slow to a fucking crawl.
Because it's a journey story for the second act, and essentially we just see all the various roadblocks on the journey. So there's one part where they stop to camp, and there's a discussion about who's going to stay up and watch the witch in the cage that they're keeping her in.
Who's on witch watch?
Who's on witch watch?
Witch. And witch watcher will witch watch.
That's right. Turns out it's Eckhart. Think about the future. And he tells a story in front of the witch about his dead daughter, who the witch reminds him of. Long story short, that leads to a whole situation where they can't find Anna. They have to go search for her in the village because she escapes. And Eckhart is made to believe that he sees his daughter, whose Mila. Name is Mila. Yeah.
Which really made me wish we were watching Resident Evil.
Yeah. But he thinks he sees his daughter. Turns out it's actually Kai, and Kai accidentally stabs and kills him. They do get the witch back. She gets put back in her cage, and they continue on. There's a long sequence about whether or not they're going to get over a bridge, which not only slows the movie down to almost dead pacing-wise, it also makes the demon that is possessing Anna, spoiler alert, it makes their ultimate plan make no sense. Because she spends the entire time on the bridge asking to be let out of the cage.
But she's like, hey, let me out of the cage and I can help you. I think she really does want to help at that point.
But she's not really saying she can help. She's saying that...
No, she literally says, I can help.
She says that the carriage that the horses are pulling will be lighter if she's not in it.
Yeah, and then she says, I can help.
Okay. Maybe she's actually being honest there. I don't know.
Yeah.
But the implication is that she's asking to be let out so she can escape, right?
Yes. Yes.
Because that is also the story of the entire second act, is trying to make you wonder if she's innocent like Felsen and Baemin seem to believe, or if she's really a witch. But she does a number of things that make you think – absolutely, definitely, she has supernatural powers, at least. Like,
yeah, and she does attempt to escape a couple times, which I think is the bigger problem with this plot.
She Kai falls over the side of the bridge. She pulls him up very easily. Like, just yoink, right up. She makes Nicolas Cage's torch go out and then light again. She obviously creates an apparition that Eckhart sees of his daughter.
Yeah, did we mention that when Kai is stabbing Eckhart, Eckhart is seeing his daughter.
Yeah.
Mila the whole time.
Yeah. Mila. Yeah. Also, she can summon wolves, because what happens immediately after the bridge thing is that they go to that forest, much like the Pine Barrens.
The Wormwood Forest.
And she does a wolf howl from inside of the cage, summoning dozens of wolves to come attack the party. In that fray, I don't think anybody dies, but people get seriously hurt.
No, Al Capone dies.
Hagamar, yes. Hagamar dies there.
In that scene, yeah.
That's right.
Because he's like, I say we just go ahead and kill her right now and tell everybody she tried to escape. And Nicolas Cage is like, if we do that, then those men will have died in vain.
And then he dies because wolves.
Yeah, he gets hit by wolves.
As Cardinal Dean Ambrose would say, wolves. That's my favorite thing about pro wrestler Dean Ambrose, is that he doesn't say wolves, he says wolves. Anyway, they finally, Nicolas Cage finally has enough. He can't take it anymore. And he pulls out his crossbow, and he points it at the witch, and he says, I can't take it anymore. We gotta kill her. She's created too much turmoil, and men have died. What if we all die before we get there? And the priest stands in front of her and says, like, no, we have to do this the right way. If we don't do the ceremony, we won't get rid of the plague, and even more people will die. Yeah. Nicolas Cage pushes him aside, and then Ron Perlman walks up and he goes, no, we can't do that, because Sevrak is literally right there. And he points to the monastery, which you can see very easily on the horizon.
Only a model.
It's only a model. But that's the one part where Nicolas Cage is kind of doing a British accent also.
Yeah.
He's like, too many people have died.
Another thing that you told me while we were watching this came out, what, 3 months, 3 weeks?
This premiered in January 2011.
Uh-huh.
The first season of Game of Thrones premiered in April 2011.
Which is unbelievable. Like, because they are, like, wearing – they're wearing bad Jon Snow cosplay, but it's not. It can't possibly be.
No, if anything, Game of Thrones took their aesthetic from this.
Yeah, Game of Thrones. George R. R. Martin basically ripped off Season of the Witch starring Nicolas Cage and Ron Perlman. For everything he ever did. And we know it, and now you know it.
Sorry to disappoint.
Yeah. Sorry, everybody.
So since they're right there at Sevrak, they go in and find basically everybody dead. Everybody has been afflicted with plague.
Yeah.
And there's maybe like one guy in there still alive. Because the priest starts freaking out and saying the Lord's Prayer. Like, he gets down and starts screaming the Lord's Prayer, and one of the few living monks in the monastery finishes the prayer.
Yeah, I did a very good Spider-Man, Sam Raimi Spider-Man callback.
Finish it! Finish it! So
that scene rules. Like, I feel like a lot of people thought that scene was way too silly when it first happened, but guess what? That shit is awesome.
Yeah. Those movies are good, actually.
We started watching Spider-Man 3 like the other night, and then we got tired and went to bed, but Spider-Man 3 is actually very good.
All the monks are dead, but the traveling party does manage to find the Key of Solomon.
Yes. And they find out that the monks were copying it. You know, like monks make copies of shit. It's the only thing they do.
They were scribes, indeed.
Yeah. It was like their job for several hundred years.
It's never stated, but it's heavily implied that this is kind of the only copy of the Key of Solomon.
Yeah.
The only one in Latin, I guess.
Absolutely not true, but...
Absolutely not true, but it's the entire plot of the movie hinges on this being the only extant copy of the Key of Solomon.
Yes.
Because when the priest, de Belzac, starts doing the ritual, because they ask if he can do it, and he says, okay. So they go outside to the cage on the carriage, and he starts performing the ritual. The girl... The witch starts flipping out because turns out that was her plan all along,
yeah,
to come to Severac and get that book.
Because she's like, hey, check it out. I'm actually evil, you fucking idiot. But I knew if I was Claire Foy that you would want to protect me, and you played right into my hands.
Because she's not a witch. She hasn't been a witch this entire time. The title of this movie is a lie.
It is at that.
She is, in fact, demon-possessed. And so she turns into a Army of Darkness-ass deadite.
Yeah.
Which pretty knocks the shit out of the priest. Knocks the shit out of Nicolas Cage, too. And goes flying off. Like, she grows wings and flies off. Exactly like Sunset Shimmer. The plot of this movie, extremely similar to the first My Little Pony Friendship is Magic film.
Yeah, because this adorable young lady turns into a Satan, mm-hmm, and then causes trouble over a magic book.
That's right, because what she wanted this entire time was this one and only copy of The Key of Solomon, which includes the instructions for a ritual to exorcise a demon. She is not exorcised here. In fact, she manages to get the drop on the party and attacks everybody. She gets her hands on the book for one moment, even though the book burns her hands.
I don't think the book burns her. Isn't that Nicolas Cage pouring holy water on her?
Could be. I don't.
She looks up and she's like, oh, Nicolas Cage.
A lot of the action in this sequence is a little hard to follow, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
But it's essentially...
All the bad parts of Army of Darkness.
Yeah. Essentially, the priest continues reading the exorcism part of the Key of Solomon, but he is killed before he can finish because the demon literally drops in behind him and snaps his neck, the easiest thing in the world.
Yeah, and it's like, why I am not sure why the ritual got that close to finishing, if that was an option.
Yeah. Then Felsen tries to hold off the demon, and he gets burned in a big old bear hug.
Which, that was his move back in Crusade times, which we know because he did it exactly once.
Also, he tells... Baemin, that Baemin is definitely buying the drinks tonight.
Yeah.
Which is the extent of their complete and total extent of their friendship. Then
I don't know why you need it more. It's very funny to me.
Then Baemin finally holds off the demon while Kai finishes reading in Latin the rest of the exorcism portion of the Key of Solomon. The demon is banished. It burns up. And fly, like the fire kind of flies up to the ceiling. And then the young girl who we find out is named Anna, as she and Kai bury Nicolas Cage, Ron Perlman, and de Belzac, she is lying on the floor, undemoned. And then Kai and Anna ride off, having saved the Key of Solomon, and Anna says that she will tell the world about the men who saved her life.
Yeah.
Chris, what have we got for high points of Season of the Witch?
Oh, Matt Wilson, you did not mention the best part of the climax, and also probably the weirdest part of the climax.
Hit me.
The demon at one point.
Yes, okay, yeah.
The demon speaks to Nicolas Cage, and he's like, I need that book. You gotta give me that book. That book is giving demons so much trouble. The demon has a southern act. The demon sounds like us.
Pretty much.
Bananas. It's like they got Danny McBride in to do a demon voice for some reason.
It's like he did a Kenny Powers book on tape for the demon.
Man, I was in Season of the Witch.
Y'all didn't even know it before I wrote Halloween. I was in horror movies before that.
It's wild. And it okay, that made it into the movie. So either there is a truly catastrophic amount of not giving a fuck, or they knew exactly, like somebody was like, we got all these accents in here. What is one more?
I will say that my biggest high point of the movie are any of the moments where it embraces its goofy B-horror movie campiness.
Yeah, because the movie is goofy.
It's goofy as hell. Like, all the Crusade stuff is goofy as hell. The costumes are so goofy. And another thing that I didn't mention from the climax is the demon kind of just disappears for a while and sends the plague-infested monks after our heroes for a bit. So
there's deadites for a minute.
Those are another set of deadites that they have to fight. And at one point, Nicolas Cage figures out how to kill him, which is you got to cut their head off. And so when they get their heads cut off, this kind of like soul mist comes out of their necks. And that's fucking fantastic, yeah. Right? It's so goofy B-movie monster shit.
It's very Sam Raimi.
I wanted so much more of that from this movie because, like, when it does it pretty well. It just, like, withholds it a lot of the time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's I mean, this is getting to low point, but it does seem like the movie is at cross purposes with itself.
Yeah, and we can get in more into that with low points, but in those moments where it does embrace its full campiness, where the demon is like full on Mortal Kombat Annihilation CGI and talking in a southern accent, that's when the movie like got my attention back, you know? Any other high points, Chris? I'll say goofy wigs and goofy costumes.
Yeah, like I think the goofiness, the good goofiness, kind of encompasses everything that is enjoyable about this movie. Because when it embraces itself, it's good. But it is the word goofy defines this film.
All right, Chris, what have we got for low points? I think you're right on the money about the being at cross purposes, because there are times, especially in the middle of this movie, where it takes itself very seriously.
Yeah. It's like this movie could be fun, but that's where the bad goofiness comes in. Like, one of the first things I said watching it was literally, this is goofy. And it's like, it is the word. But they take it so seriously, but not in the way where, like, they're playing it straight so that we can all enjoy it. It's like, this movie is meant to be taken very seriously despite being very silly and very bad.
Well, the entirety of the second act, which, you know, I talked about being the road trip part of the movie and being the doughy middle.
That section's terrible.
Well, the sort of mystery of that part of the movie, mm-hmm. what the audience doesn't know and what they're supposed to be guessing at is whether Claire Foy is really a witch or not, and whether the priest, de Belzac, is like as bad as she says he is. Like,
yeah,
you're supposed to be guessing, like, who's the real bad guy, right? And even though it is established that de Belzac did actually beat and torture her, he ends up being, like, a good guy by the end of it.
Yeah.
And her twist is that, yeah, she's an evil occult figure, but she's a demon, not a witch.
Yeah, she's a different bad guy.
And both of those are kind of disappointing. There's no nuance to them. And you know from the first minute you see her that she's definitely a witch.
Yeah.
Like, there's, like, because we know witches exist from the prologue, from the cold open, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah, it's not like how there used to be three different kinds of demons in D&D, and so you would have a weapon that would hurt one but not the others. It's not like they get to the end and like, oh man, we brought the wrong sword.
Yeah.
It's like
they just have to turn to a different page in the Key of Solomon. That's it. Like, there's no tension in the tension, you know? Yeah.
Also, I am, like, generally uncomfortable with movies where the witch hunters are absolutely correct, like, to be doing what they are doing. And
that's fair.
Like, that is not the best, I think. I mean, but yeah, like, the fact that the movie doesn't work with its own – the movie rejects its own premise, which is a thing a movie rarely does.
Speaking of – I asked at one point, what is Nicolas Cage's character arc in this movie?
Mm-hmm.
Because he is a soldier at first who loses his faith and quits the battlefield, right?
Right.
And there could be something interesting about him being someone who doesn't trust the church, who's on this mission for the church, but it's not for the church, it's for him and for his own personal growth, and he wants to protect this girl. But that's not what the movie ends up being about. He ends up just going on another crusade and dying for another crusade. And that sucks.
Yeah, it's really bad.
That story sucks.
Yeah, there is a lack of tension. There is a lack of character arc. Even if this movie had done a little more on that journey to kind of play with the idea of who is actually the witch, is it de Belzac or is it Claire Foy? Like, that would have even been something.
Yeah, it's just like anything that is kind of presented as a twist in this movie is either choreographed or totally out of left field.
Mm-hmm.
And Nicolas Cage's character changes only to change back, which is very unsatisfying.
Yeah. It's not good. It's not a good film. It's not a fun film either.
Well, and let me ask you this.
Yeah.
Because you don't understand why I need more of a relationship between Felsen and Bayman, but what do you know about Ron Perlman's character? Other than he cares about whether to buy drinks, who's buying drinks.
Mm-hmm.
He bear hugs people, and he fucks.
He definitely fucks. That is established at least a couple of times.
Uh-huh.
That he defos gets it on. But that's kind of about it. Like, he definitely fucked that girl in France, because they mention it very specifically.
Right, and she took all his money, but gave him so much more.
Yeah. I mean, he's affable, but that's all he is. Like, he's weirdly affable because Nicolas Cage is so serious.
He's the friend.
Yeah, Ron Perlman is Nicolas Cage's comedy sidekick in this movie, which is bonkers. Ron Perlman should have died in the war. Right? Like, wouldn't that be a better, like, if his friend dies and then he... And then he's like, what did he die for? You know, that's a better thing. I mean,
that would have been a better motivation than accidentally killing a white lady.
Yeah. That's also very bad.
Yeah.
That's also very bad. A lot of very bad in this movie. This movie actually gets worse the more I think about it.
All right, Chris, speaking of thinking about it, what are our final thoughts about Season of the Witch?
I definitely feel Matt Wilson. Like, I would have enjoyed 110 minutes of The Vampire's Assistant almost certainly more than I enjoyed 90 minutes of this.
I mean, I guess we can find out by eventually watching The Vampire's Assistant and discovering whether that movie's boring or not.
I mean, I don't expect that movie to be a good.
Yeah. I do think the movies we have the hardest time with and the movies that end up being kind of the worst and most boring that we watch for this show are always the movies that can't figure out what they are. And Season of the Witch is absolutely that. Your description of saying that it's at cross purposes with itself is so, so super true. Because
half the people who made this movie wanted to make Army of Darkness.
It seems like it.
And someone who made this movie did not.
Yeah, because if the movie had just been kind of full-on campy, it could have been something good.
Yeah. This movie takes itself way more seriously than even the Vin Diesel Witch Hunter movie did, which is a real shame.
Yeah, I mean, it takes itself more seriously than Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters.
Yeah, that movie at least tries to be funny and fails.
We watched back in the band camp days of this show.
Did we watch it? Why I saw that movie?
Yeah, we watched it for the Bandcamp version of this.
Wow, show. Matt, I cannot remember any movies that I've seen on this show.
Well, this is probably one we're going to forget to. So
yeah, there's nothing memorable about this movie.
Except that one Nicolas Cage wig. I'll think about that wig in the future.
That's that memory I'll treasure for sure.
But guess what, everybody? Next month, October, Movie Fighters 100. We're doing it. We got to do something special for it. So if you have an idea for a number 100 movie, hit us up. We already have a special plan for something we're going to do for that episode. But if you can think of a movie that would be like super special for us to watch on number 100, and no, I can already tell you, we are not going to be watching Southland Tales. We're not going to be watching Southland Tales.
What's Southland Tales?
Is that also
about horse girls?
It's not. It's a movie where The Rock plays a nervous guy, directed by the Donnie Darko guy.
Yeah, I remember that coming out. Why would that be our movie?
I don't know if it's one fan or a group of fans continually suggest that we watch Southland Tales. I've already seen it. There's no chance in hell I am ever watching that movie again.
Please put the music drop in, Matt.
Well, you already did it. You just did it. Yeah. But if you do have an idea for what a movie we could watch for number 100, let us know. We will mull it over as well for that very special episode that is coming up in October. It is an October episode, so maybe it should be a little spooky.
A little spooky scary.
A little spooky scary. But
maybe
we'll be back
for Happy Death Day.
Maybe if people tell us that it's worth watching and not too scary, we'll watch Happy Death Day.
Yeah, and don't lie to me, because I will legitimately get scared and not have a good time.
We will be back then for number 100. In the meantime, you can help us out by heading over to patreon.com/warrocketajax and kicking in as little as $1 per month to make sure that we keep doing this show and all our other podcasts here in the Clytus Media family of podcasts. Also, want to let you know that our website was designed by Sean Wagus. Our theme song is by Michael Kill. Thanks for listening, everybody. If you watched Season of the Witch, thanks for getting through it with us.
Sorry.
See you in October for number 100.
This has been a Clytus Media production.